From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf.
We're going to start today with a curious document.
Pretty amazing.
Historian Elizabeth Reese brought it into the studio for us.
It's only maybe four paragraphs long.
But in those four paragraphs, we get a very unusual drama from 1629.
It's from the minutes of the Council and General Court of Colonial Virginia.
A note to parents. If children are in the room, you might want to turn the radio down for a few minutes.
That day in 1629 in Virginia, the court heard the case of a man, maybe a woman. We don't really know. And that's what the court wanted to find out. The man in question, and we'll call him a man because the court called him a man and we don't know his preference, was an indentured servant named Thomas Hall. Now, Thomas Hall sometimes dressed as a man, and he sometimes dressed as a woman, going by the name Thomasine. That ambiguity troubled colonial Virginians.
And so basically they're trying to figure out what his body looks like, what's the most socially appropriate role for him to be dressed as. Should he be dressed as a man? Should he be dressed as a woman?
People present at the court were clearly very worked up about the question of Hall's true sex. So right there in the courtroom, a man named Roger Rhodes took matters into his own hands. The court records describe what happened next.
The said Rhodes told Hall, "Thou hast been reported to be a woman, and now thou art presumed to be a man. I will see what thou carriest."
The records describe a disturbing assault. Rhodes threw Hall down on the floor and tore off his clothing to inspect his genitals. He then announced that Hall was, in fact, a man. But when other authorities tried to confirm that, the story shifted.
But the said Tyos, that's another person involved, swore the said Hall was a woman.
Things got even more confusing from there. A group of women crept into Hall's chambers at night in order to inspect his body while he slept. But even then, they couldn't decide if Hall was male or female.
Finally, the court simply asked Thomas Hall directly, "Are you a man or are you a woman?"
It says here, the said Hall replied he was both.
Reese thinks that Hall likely possessed elements of both male and female genitalia, what today we call intersex. But that answer didn't work for the legal system in 1620s Virginia. That's because society at the time relied on heterosexual marriage, modeled on the relationship between Adam and Eve. If Hall was both male and female, well, heterosexual marriage wasn't an option. So any sexual relationship he entered into would be transgressive.
The fear is that people who aren't identified specifically as male or female might have sex with the wrong sex. If you're not sure if you're male or female, then how would you know what a heterosexual coupling would be?
Eventually, the court came up with a rather unusual ruling. They ordered Hall to wear an outfit that mixed male and female clothing, a shirt and pants, plus a type of bonnet and apron.
It shouldn't be interpreted as, oh, weren't they so liberal back then? They're letting him go around as a man and a woman, and they're letting him be his intersex self. They're not.
Instead, the court was making Hall a public spectacle. Anybody who saw the outlandish getup would immediately understand the message. This person is not an appropriate sexual partner.
And once the punishment was handed down, Thomas or Thomasine Hall is lost to history.
But though the case was officially closed, it left some unsettling questions in its wake. What counts as acceptable sexual behavior? How do societies deal with people who don't quite fit into the categories of the day? Nearly 400 years later, we're still grappling with many of these issues.
As the Winter Olympics begin in Sochi this week, President Obama has expressed concern about anti-LGBT laws in Russia.
And there's plenty of controversy at home, too. States like Utah and Oklahoma are in the midst of court battles over the legality of banning same-sex marriage.
So today on the show, we're exploring the history of sexual identity. How did people think about sexuality before the invention of terms like gay and straight? And how do historians reconstruct histories that were often kept purposely secret?
We're going to start today in 1950s Washington, D.C., where Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy spearheaded an infamous campaign to root out communists within the government. Today, we call it the Red Scare. But McCarthy also led a lesser-known campaign against gays and lesbians, now dubbed the Lavender Scare. As a result, government agencies fired between 5,000 and 10,000 LGBT employees. The purge came as a shock to longtime Washingtonians.
Many people who were in Washington in the 30s and 40s describe it as a very tolerant place.
This is historian David Johnson. He says pre-World War II D.C. attracted ambitious young workers with a live-and-let-live attitude.
There were talks about gay parties in D.C. There were stories of men holding hands on the trolley cars in D.C.
Enter Joe McCarthy. In February 1950, McCarthy grabbed headlines by claiming there were exactly 205 card-carrying communists working in the State Department. But for all the talk about communists, David Johnson says that the focus actually pivoted to homosexuals pretty quickly.
When he finally gets around to giving details about this alleged list in the Senate a few weeks later, he actually shows that several of these cases were not about communists at all, but they were about homosexuals who had been hired in the State Department. And his charges that gay people had infiltrated the federal government sort of captured the national imagination, particularly when the State Department responded by saying, oh, no, we have no communists in the State Department, and we've never had any communists, and we've never gotten rid of any communists. But we have dismissed 202 people we consider to be security risks. And under very intense questioning, these State Department officials admit that, well, 91 of them were homosexual. And this seems to, in fact, substantiate McCarthy's otherwise pretty groundless charges and sets off a kind of lavender scare. People want to know, well, why were these people hired and where did they go and are there any more? And there are congressional investigations that are held in the summer of 1950 on the employment of homosexuals and other sex perverts in the government. That was the title of the investigation. And then in 1953, Eisenhower becomes president. He signs an executive order which specifically uses the term sexual perversion as a grounds for dismissal.
We know that the Red Scare got so much ink in the first half of the 1950s. How did the publicity about the Lavender Scare compare to that?
We tend to think of the 50s as a time when people and the media in particular didn't talk about homosexuality, which is not true. The idea about sex perverts infiltrating the federal government and the State Department in particular was all over the headlines. They like to use the word pervert. You know, perverts pose government peril.
they liked alliteration.
But the difference with between the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare is that there were no individual cases of gay people, you know, publicly brought before a congressional committee and asked, you know, are you now or have you ever been a homosexual? Most of the interrogations of suspected gay men and lesbians happened behind closed doors. They happened in, you know, small security offices in government agencies throughout Washington where people would be brought in and asked, you know, the Civil Service Commission has information that you are a homosexual. What comment do you care to make?
How was the crackdown on homosexuals related to the crackdown on communists in government agencies?
Well, the official position of the government was that homosexuals could be blackmailed by communists into giving up government secrets. But in the popular imagination, there were all kinds of other ways in which the two groups were conflated, that they were both seen as evidence of psychological weakness.
I see.
Both groups are seen as these sort of hidden subcultures with their own cultural codes, their own literature, their own meeting places.
How long did discriminatory legislation and regulations like the executive order. How long did these stay on the books?
Right. So Eisenhower signs this executive order in 1953. People bring court cases claiming this is, you know, unconstitutional, and they win by the late 60s.
So we're talking a good 15 years after the executive order.
But even then, even when they win in the courts in 1969, probably the pivotal case, the civil service is very slow at changing its policy. It takes it another 6 years to remove the language about immoral conduct from its policies.
So 1975.
Right. The good news is that the level of oppression and suspicion was so great that it spawned a new level of resistance among gay men and lesbians, particularly in Washington, D.C., which was hardest hit.
Sure.
So you have a new gay organization that's founded in Washington in 1960, the Mattachine Society of Washington. It's founded by a man who was fired from the federal government in the 1950s for being gay. And he fights his dismissal and he loses, and he helps found this organization, which lobbies the government, writes letters, helps marshal other legal fights through the legal system. And by 1965, they're picketing in front of the White House. So it became sort of standard, the sort of methods and tactics that the movement has used ever since.
So, David, what do you think Americans should take away from this story?
Yeah, we have this notion, I think, that gay people have always been a hated minority and discriminated against, and that goes back generations, if not centuries. But in fact, if you look at the historical record more closely, you see that the level of fear and hysteria and oppression that occurred in the 50s with the Lavender Scare was really unprecedented. And we've come to see that now almost as normal, when in fact it was a particular cultural moment whose effects have lingered for a very long time.
David Johnson is a historian at the University of South Florida. His book is The Lavender Scare, The Cold War Persecution of Gays and Lesbians in the Federal Government.
I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. Today on the show, we're looking at the history of sexual identity in America.
In 1882, a woman named Delia Hudson moved to the tiny town of Wampum, Wisconsin, to start a new life. She had left her husband and two children behind in Illinois.
And in this new life, Delia committed to dressing and living as a man. She even went by the name Frank Du Bois. Now, from this point forward in the story, that's the name we'll use. We're also going to refer to Frank as he, since that appears to be what he wanted.
Shortly after arriving in Wampum, Frank married a woman named Gertrude Fuller. Historian Emily Skidmore says he passed his days pretty conventionally, working as a painter to support his new wife.
Really, by all accounts, the marriage was a fairly happy one until October of the following year, October 1883, when Sam Hudson, Du Bois's former husband, arrives in Wampum with their two daughters.
Skidmore says that when Frank caught wind that his former family was around, he and Gertrude skipped town, trailed by the police.
For several weeks, both Frank Du Bois and Gertrude Fuller are on the lam, right, traveling throughout Wisconsin from small town to small town. And this really initiates really a firestorm of coverage in the media. It's covered not just in Wampum, but really in newspapers around the country.
But newspapers struggled to interpret the story of a woman who left her family to live as a man and then married a woman. They resorted to describing Frank as a female husband, a term that had been used to describe a handful of similar cases in the past. But even that term left people scratching their heads.
The local Wampum Times admitted that it was entirely perplexed. The paper remarked, quote, "There is no known or imaginable motive for such strange conduct, if it be true," end quote. When I sat down with historian Emily Skidmore, I asked her why the situation was so baffling to the press.
this case makes the news in 1883. And at the time, same-sex desire, especially in women, wasn't something that was really imaginable, because there really was no framework for understanding why a woman would want to dress as a man and act as a husband, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas today, we might think about Frank Du Bois as transgender, and that would be a framework for us to understand his actions, right? But in the absence of any framework like that, readers and newspaper editors throughout the nation were really puzzled by this. This was still in the Victorian era. Women were understood to be passionless, right, without any innate sexual desire. So sexual desire between two women, right, was unimaginable.
So now what happens?
They're finally found in late November of 1883, and Frank Du Bois is arrested. And only then does Frank Du Bois admit that, yes, biologically he is a woman. And the story they tell to explain their marriage is that Gertrude Fuller had become pregnant, out of wedlock pregnancy. With some other person. And so Frank Du Bois enters the scene and marries her in order to cover up the unwed pregnancy, right? And that's the story they tell, right? And that's a very, in some ways, it's a lovely story, right? It paints Frank Du Bois as an individual who is very selfless, chivalrous in some ways, stepping in where another man had left Gertrude Fuller in the lurch.
So is it true? Did Gertrude have a child?
Well, what's interesting is that the math really doesn't add up. So the couple, Du Bois and Fuller, get married in December of 1882. She certainly would have given birth by October the following year, but there's no evidence even in late 1883 that she ever gave birth to a child.
You know, one of the things that you've written about is sort of the invention of the new science of sexology, of people actually exploring sexual identity in a scientific way. And it's very interesting the way you analyze the language that the press used. And you found that the language that the press used to describe this situation of a female husband disappears pretty quickly in the 1890s and is replaced by the language of lesbianism. Can you explain how that happened and what we might make of that?
Sure, yeah. Frank Du Bois is actually one of the very last people who is described as being a, quote, female husband, right? In fact, the New York Times, Frank Du Bois is the last person who's described as a female husband. We see the term really falling out of favor by the 1880s and for sure the 1890s. Uh-huh. And the disappearance of the term, I think, is really interesting in what it suggests about the understanding of same-sex desire. So by 1890, the idea of same-sex desire between women, which had been so unimaginable earlier in the 19th century, more Americans are being exposed to that idea and being exposed to, you know, maybe two women living together. There is something going on there. And so as that identity category is being introduced, right, the category of the lesbian, or what sexologists would refer to as the female sexual invert, it's becoming pathologized, right? It's becoming an identity category that is understood to be deviant and pathological.
So as soon as its reality is acknowledged, it's considered a disease. Right, so
right,
there's no
absolutely
golden age in which people just sort of say, "Hey, that exists."
And so, I think that's an important backdrop to understanding why the term "female husband" falls out of favor.
So, the press had a field day with the story of Frank Du Bois. How would they have dealt with a case such as this, say, 20 years later? Would there have been a revolution in the storytelling that went along with this invention of the phrase of lesbianism?
So there's actually another example from Wisconsin. I don't know why Wisconsin has so many of these very, very fascinating stories, but another one of my favorite stories that I write about happens in Wisconsin in 1914. An individual, Ralph Carwinio, was biologically female, but was living as a man, living as Ralph Carwinio, had been married to a woman, goes out, finds another woman, has a second marriage. His first wife is so upset at this, goes and turns Ralph Carwinio into the authorities. Says, actually, this man, Ralph Carwinio, who had been living as my husband for so many years, he is biologically a woman. And so this begins another episode where the press is going crazy around the story. And the way the national press talks about it is automatically Ralph Carwinio is a deviant, is someone who is pathological, and how terrible he took advantage of this poor woman. But what's fascinating is that what the Milwaukee papers really do is they interview Ralph Carwinio's former bosses, and they're trying to understand what his life as a man was like. And if his life as a man was respectable, then his foray into masculinity was understood as something that was, you know, kind of okay.
It suggests that people in the communities themselves could accept a situation about which they might have doubts or reservations or suspicions, but it's these individual people that, and we've grown to like them, okay, just leave them alone.
Absolutely, right? They're community members, right? And so there's more of a desire to create a narrative that illuminates why they would embark upon a life as a man. That is totally invisible if you're just looking at the national press. On the national level, Ralph Carwinio is a deviant.
Emily Skidmore is a historian at Texas Tech University. To read more about Frank Du Bois, Ralph Carwinio, and the media frenzy they inspired, visit our website at backstoryradio.org. One of the things that interests me in that episode is really the way that people's identity seemed not fixed in the categories that we understand today. I mean, people didn't have words for gay or homosexual. And as a result, their identity seemed open for negotiation, kind of fluid.
Well, Ed, I think the whole problem is with our notions of identity, of authenticity, of who we really are. Mm-hmm. Identities at this time and these places, they're conferred by the community. You are what you do. You perform certain roles in that community, and you build up trust.
You're the butcher or you're the baker.
Yeah, exactly right. You're seen playing a variety of conspicuous roles, and that's the important thing. Nobody's going to break down the doors to find out what goes on inside that house because they know you as the person who performs within the community. And I think the big arc of the story that we're talking about here is we have an emergence of a new kind of identity because of big social change. And the social change, I think, Ed, over the late 19th century and well into the 20th century, has to do with urbanization and the aggregation of people in communities of their own choosing.
You imagine you're a Frank Du Bois. It makes a lot more sense to get out of Wampum, Wisconsin, and go to Chicago or go to New York, where there are other people who are trying to find their way in the society the same way that you are. But when they become visible in that way, then they make themselves liable to laws that apply to groups of people.
I got to come back to these categories. Mm-hmm. Terms like homosexual, terms like lesbian, and eventually terms like bisexual and transgender. And they're not just scientific categories applied to groups in society. They actually are used to enforce laws, some of them very old laws. And we know in Chicago, in New York, in many urban areas, these laws are used to harass homosexuals because they are homosexuals. We know that by the 1950s, employers are saying, we will not employ homosexuals, that they're very explicit about this.
Well, you can't be threatened by an individual within a village community, but a class of people, people you don't know, who have a different priorities, who come from a different place, classes can be threatening. And it's the response of the of mass society to the threat perceived in cities, which are always sickly, pathological places in the American imagination. That's where evil dwells. And you've got to control and contain it. You have to improve cities. You have to get rid of the pathologies and sicknesses.
So it sounds like two things happen. You get critical mass of people with a certain identity, and you have a name for that identity.
Yep.
And then you can discriminate against them.
That's exactly right.
At the same time, those same people can mobilize themselves to defend themselves and to make a place literally for themselves in the eyes of the law.
Ed, you're so right about using the law to vindicate this identity. And we've seen that play out in laws that have been challenged on sodomy, and now laws that have been challenged about the right to marriage. But the great irony here is before the gay community can change the laws, they need to change the way we think about those categories. They basically embrace those categories, which were used originally to pathologize homosexuality. And they go really to the belly of the beast. They go to the American Psychiatric Association, which had categorized homosexuality as a pathology. They say, this is not a pathology. This is a category that we embrace. They own that a category, and that identity becomes the basis for challenging the law. In 1890, a young Englishman named John Addington Symonds wrote to one of America's most famous poets, Walt Whitman, then nearly 80 years old. Symonds had a simple question. Were some of Whitman's most erotic poems actually about men?
People had speculated about Whitman's relationships for decades. In the 1850s, one critic accused Whitman of that horrible sin not to be mentioned among Christians. Oscar Wilde claimed to have kissed him and suggested even more.
Whitman wrote back to Symonds and denied that he was attracted to men. He claimed to have fathered six children. And for decades, scholars took Whitman at his word.
But in the last 30 years, new readings of the available evidence suggest Whitman did have male lovers, which has strengthened his status as a gay icon. That's opened up a thorny question. How should we describe the sexuality of someone who lived before our modern categories were invented? Jesse Dukes tells the story of one contemporary gay poet's struggle to answer that question.
In the early 1990s, Richard Tayson almost got into a fight about Walt Whitman.
It seems preposterous and crazy to think that someone would actually fight over poetry in an East Village bar.
This was a gay bar, sweaty, crowded with low light, a pinball machine, industrial music. The night of the fight, Richard was drinking tequila with a nice-looking blonde guy named Jim. Richard usually dreaded telling guys he was a grad student studying poetry, but it turned out Jim liked poetry too.
And I thought how great it is that we both like a lot of the same music and we have poetry in common, and he even knows who Whitman is.
The trouble started when Jim called Whitman America's greatest gay poet. And Richard, the serious grad student, told Jim he had two problems with calling Whitman gay. One, there wasn't really evidence that Whitman was attracted to men. That was just a rumor. And two, it wasn't fair for the gay community to claim Whitman as one of their own, especially since Whitman had famously denied it.
And he then after became irate, upset, and he accused me of being more homophobic than straight people are against gay people.
Jim actually took a swing at Richard and wanted to take the fight outside, but Richard ducked away and lost him in the crowd. Walking home quickly through the East Village, he was shaken up, and he decided he needed to learn more about Walt Whitman.
I wanted to prove Jim wrong. My notion was that I would show him that I wasn't homophobic and that he was incorrect about Whitman's sexuality.
Richard started looking at the handful of scholarly works that actually explored the possibility of Whitman's homosexuality. He read a collection of letters written to Whitman by a man named Fred Vaughan. Vaughan was a carriage driver and much younger than Whitman. According to the letters, the two men were very close. They actually lived together in the 1850s in Brooklyn and used to take the ferry to Manhattan, where they frequented a bohemian bar called Pfaff's.
One flitting glimpse caught through an interstice.
This poem, written around the same time, gives us a glimpse of how the two might have shared intimate moments at the bar, surrounded by a crowd of freethinkers who didn't give them a second glance.
And I, unremarked, seated in a corner, of a youth who loves me and whom I love, silently approaching and seating himself near, that he may hold me by the hand a long while.
In the 1850s, it was common for male friends to hold hands or to express their affection for each other in very romantic terms. Even so, when Richard read about Whitman and Vaughan, he was struck by the possibility the two men were lovers. But it was an unpublished poem called Live Oak with Moss that really amazed Richard. The long poem was lost for nearly 100 years. Reconstructed in the 1950s, it appears to tell the story of a love affair between two men. Here's an excerpt.
Hours discouraged, distracted. For the one I cannot content myself without, soon I saw him content himself without me. Hours when I am forgotten. Sullen and suffering hours. I am ashamed, but it is useless. I am what I am.
It doesn't, quote-unquote, prove Whitman's homosexuality, but it's circumstantially very appealing to think that Whitman was writing about a situation that many people during his lifetime would have condemned, and during ours.
I wonder if other men ever have the like out of the like feelings. Is there even one other like me, distracted, his friend, his lover, lost to him?
For a gay person to read this poem is a remarkable experience because every single man or woman who is not of the conventional sexual orientation knows exactly what it feels like to feel like I am the only one that ever felt this. I'm the only one on this planet that has the misfortune of being unlike all the people around me.
Some people think Fred Vaughn, the young man from Brooklyn, is the lover that Whitman writes about in the poem. If so, they only had a few years together. According to the letters, they drifted apart in the late 1850s, and in 1861, Vaughn married a woman. He invited Whitman to attend the wedding, but the poet didn't even answer. 10 years later, Vaughn sent this letter to Whitman.
Walt, driver hour. I, loafing in a lumber yard at the foot of 35th Street.
In the letter, Vaughn appears to be telling Whitman how much he misses him.
Walt, my life has turned out a poor, miserable failure. I am not a drunkard, nor a teetotaler. I am neither honest or dishonest. I have my family in Brooklyn and am supporting them. I never stole, robbed, cheated, or defrauded any person out of anything. And yet I feel that I have not been honest to myself, my family, nor my friends.
He seems to be getting so close to the modern notion of homosexuality relations that I can read these letters in a way that presupposes them having been written in our time. How many people have I known that did that? Married, had children, and then realized when their children are 8, 10, 14 that they're gay. This feels like that kind of thing.
Richard has come to understand why other LGBT people relate to Whitman and Vaughn. It's easy to imagine the two men struggling with feelings and dilemmas still common today. And he thinks Jim, the guy at the gay bar, was probably right about Whitman's attraction to men. Still, all the evidence for sexual relationships is circumstantial.
I don't think that I can say, Walt, the great gay poet, I still have some problem with that idea.
After all, there's Whitman's privacy to consider. If he did have sexual relations with men, he chose to protect them from the public eye.
I think Whitman was very afraid, and I think Whitman was afraid because of his literary reputation. And I think more than a lover, more than anything in the world, Whitman wanted to be a famous writer.
Richard says he sometimes wishes that Whitman had just come out and said he was in love with Fred Vaughn. But Whitman got what he wanted. Public recognition as a great American writer. And Richard is grateful for the poems Whitman left behind, which leave us with both insights into the poet's life and with persistent mysteries.
That story was produced by Jesse Dukes with Richard Tayson, a poet and professor of writing at the New School. Whitman's poems were read by Gary Schmidtgall, a professor of English at Hunter College, and the author of the biography, Walt Whitman, A Gay Life.
It's time for a quick break. When we get back, an approach to sexual identity that predates the LGBT era and the United States itself.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Backstory.
I'm Brian Bello.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today on the show, we're looking at the history of Americans' thinking about sexual orientation.
We're going to turn now to a very different way of understanding sexual identity, one that predates European arrival to North America. In many American Indian cultures, certain people were understood to possess both masculine and feminine attributes. Sometimes these people would dress in a mixture of male and female clothing. Sometimes they would function as mediators between groups of men and groups of women.
When Europeans encountered these traditions, many were horrified. They tried to suppress them and were largely successful. By the 20th century, many Native American communities had lost pre-contact ways of thinking about gender and sexuality.
But in the late 1980s, a group of gay and lesbian Native Americans began working to reclaim the older ways of thinking about gender and sexuality. Because there were so many different traditions, they settled on the umbrella term two-spirit, describing someone who embodied both the male and the female.
I recently sat down with Harlan Pruden, a member of the Cree Nation who helped found the Northeast Two-Spirit Society. I wanted to understand how he'd gone from thinking of himself as gay to thinking of himself as two-spirit. He says he never even heard the term two-spirit until he was a sophomore in college.
I found this book called Spirit in the Flesh by Walter Williams, and it was like 1990 publication. And I ate up that book. You know, I think there's probably about 154 pages of footnotes and primary research notes. And it sent me on this line of inquiry of meeting with my elders and offering them tobacco and saying, you know, I just finished reading this book. Do we have a corresponding term within our Cree language? And they said, you know, we do know of this word, but we forgot it. And this world opened up to me of like, wow, there's this history.
Harlan, and that's just what I wanted to ask you about. I wanted to ask you about that history of what today we would call two-spirit people.
Sure. My nation, as well as I would say a vast majority, if not all, of the Native nations were heterosexual normative. We just had straight folks. And we didn't have corresponding concepts for gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. Now, within the Cree tradition, there were four different genders. There were heterosexual males, heterosexual women, female-bodied and or assigned two-spirit, and male-assigned and or bodied two-spirit. You wouldn't have two heterosexual men hooking up and having sex within their own gender. That was a social taboo. Nor would you have two heterosexual women hooking up and having sex within their own gender. Again, a taboo. And what held true for those two genders held true for the other two genders. You wouldn't have two male-bodied or male-assigned two-spirit individuals hooking up and having sex within their gender. Similarly for the two-spirit women. I, as a male-assigned or male-bodied two-spirit individual, would take a heterosexual man as my husband, outside of my gender, and my husband would do all of the things socially expected of him, including having sex. But if our relationship ever dissolved, he would go back into the pool of eligible bachelors.
So how much had you actually known about this tradition before you encountered this mind-bending book? Literally nothing.
Nothing. It is not it was not spoken of when I was growing up. And so as a young, you know, a young sissy boy growing up on my mother's reservation in northeastern Alberta, Canada, you know, I was left in this position of having to choose between being Native and being gay.
Is that because there was hostility towards gay identity within your nation?
Well, there is that, the hostility of like being a sissy boy or, you know, someone who's gay and the name calling and bullying. There's also, within the broader dominant society, there were no role models. There was nothing for me being a gay Native. It was just like dominant society, gay. And so I chose to be gay, you know, and there were no other paths. And so I, you know, emulated what was out there within the dominant culture.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. And I want to ask you, in retrospect, thinking back to your childhood, were there people who now you can see were of two spirit, but not even able to recognize that themselves, perhaps, at the time.
Yeah. There's been, yeah, like my aunt, she was two-spirit, you know, but no one spoke of it. No one said anything. And we didn't even use the word lesbian. I didn't even understand those concepts, you know. But her and her partner lived on the reservation together for many, many years.
And was there talk about this or?
Nope.
No one talked
about it. Mm-hmm. No one said anything, you know, and she was very active within tribal politics, very respected within the community, but no one said anything.
So you also chose, as I understand it, to become an activist for Two-Spirit people. It does seem like you're serving some roles that are similar to what a Two-Spirit person might have been doing even before European contact. Would you compare your role today as a Two-Spirit person to that of the historical Two-Spirit person?
I would. You know, I attended the University of Alberta. I attended SUNY Old Westbury. So I'm very schooled, but also staying very firmly grounded within my community. And so I can go back and forth between the white world and the native world. And I can, like, you know, play that and having one foot in both of the worlds and understanding and being the glue and the connection.
Sometimes mediators between two worlds get a lot of pushback from both. Does that happen to you?
No. Yes.
Which one is it?
Yes and no. The pushback that I get from the native folks are the Christian folks, and you see the same sort of stigma in the dominant society. You see that same sort of stigma. So I get pushback from them. On the LGBT side, there's this whole thing with the moniker of like LGBT, GNC, gender nonconforming, intersex, questioning, queer. And then we're rolling along as a community and saying, oh, we want our own term, Two-Spirit, you know? And so we're getting pushback from like, why can't you guys just get in line and say that you identify as LGBT or Q or G?
What's your answer to that, Harlan?
That we have to use the term Two-Spirit, because Two-Spirit is affirming of my native ethnicity and culture, as well as my gender, as well as my sexual orientation. It's an encompassing term of that where, you know, if I say that I'm gay, I can be gay here in New York, gay in Boise, Idaho, and it's independent of community.
Thank you for joining us on Backstory today.
Hi, hi. That's thank you in my language. Examaga, we don't have a goodbye.
Hi, hi. Harlan Pruden is a member of the Cree Nation and a co-founder of the Northeast Two-Spirit Society.
We've reached the point in the show where we turn to listeners who've reached out to us about this week's topic. We've got Felicity on the line from Queens, New York.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, we're great, and it's great to have you with us. Give us a question.
All right. So historically, male homosexuality has always faced really extreme social and legal censure, mm-hmm. I mean, to the point where Thomas Jefferson's proposed reform was to make the punishment just castration instead of outright death. But it seems as though female homosexuality hasn't always received the same level of targeted legislation and uh-huh. vocal social censure until fairly recently. I mean, there's obviously a lot of potential reasons for that, but the primary correlation that I've seen is that as women have entered areas of work and social life that used to be primarily male-dominated, female same-sex relationships have come to be seen as more of a threat to traditional society. So first of all, is the perception that male and female homosexuality have been treated differently really accurate? And secondly, if so, is this change really linked to the broader improvement of women's social and economic status in the U.S.?
A terrific question, Felicity. And there's no question that you're right historically about differential treatment once homosexuality was recognized, it was primarily a problem identified with males.
Right.
And the reason, and I will throw this to the guys, but the reason in many ways is you don't need a closet with female homosexuality. Women just have to behave in a certain general way, and their sexuality doesn't seem very important. And the historical reason for that is women aren't supposed to be sexually driven. They're not supposed to have sexuality, so that they're all what behaviors we call female, gendered female, don't express sexual drives.
Yeah, Peter, I want to suggest that lesbians fly beneath the public radar screen because women in general do not gain anything close to full citizenship until well into the 20th century. So why is male homosexuality more a target of public debate? Well, because of the association between men and citizenship, whereas women are expected to be regulated, controlled within the family, not by legislation per se, not by publicly outing them or even publicly talking about those relationships.
Boy, Felicity, that's some good answers, aren't they? I want to try to go directly to Felicity's question, which I think the answer is pretty direct. It was okay because there was nothing really that it threatened.
Right.
You know, in the great majority of the 18th, 19th, 20th century, for the reasons that Brian and Peter are saying, women have no political power. They have very little autonomous economic power. The fact that young women, especially in schools and in colleges, could have crushes and have flirtations with each other was seen as basically without great social consequence. So I think you're exactly right. Your implication is that people began to freak out about it when women began to actually have autonomous economic power and authority relatively close to our own times.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Does this make sense, Felicity?
It certainly does. And your point about female affection is something also that's very interesting. I had read one of those pamphlets from the 19th century, you know, about how women are supposed to act. And it's basically talking about how, you know, you shouldn't let your boyfriend make inappropriate advances, but they give as a great example, you know, the young lady who spends time with her bosom buddy, you know, who's affectionate with her. And looking from our perspective, you know, you kind of want to giggle a little bit. But right. Honestly, I think at that point, maybe people really did see that sort of female interaction as completely normal and even maybe expected.
Well, I think in our centuries, in the early period, we know what the outcome is going to be. Girls are going to grow up into women whose only place is in the home. There's no other choice. Very few women are going to be outside of the home. So it really doesn't matter what leads up to that. And the great threat in the modern period has to do with the possibility that people will end up in other places. Maybe women will choose not to be wives and mothers. And if too many do that, then the entire future is at risk.
Yeah, instead they'll choose to be bosses and presidents. And then what's going to happen?
Right? You feeling threatened there, Ed?
Not at all.
So what do you think, Felicity?
Fantastic answers. Thank you so much speaking with me.
Oh,
thank
wonderful you, to have you on the
what
line.
A great
thank
question.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to be a caller on future shows, visit us at backstoryradio.org and leave us a note. We're working on upcoming shows about the history of money and the Oscars, and we'd love to hear your take on those topics. That's going to do it for us today, but we've got plenty of extras online, including a link to The Spirit and the Flesh, the book that sparked Harlan Pruden's interest in the history of two-spirit people. You can also read more about the story of Thomas or Thomasine Hall in Elizabeth Reese's book, Bodies in Doubt.
As always, you can find a lot of other Backstory extras on our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. Our handle is Backstory Radio. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Jess Ingebretson, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, and Jesse Dukes. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Our intern is Abe Schenck. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional support is provided by Weinstein Properties and History Channel. History made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Yeah.